Okay, welcome to episode 41 of the Guru Performance We Do Science podcast. Today, I have Sean Lucan, Dr. Sean Lucan, who is a medical doctor. And am I right, Sean, you're also a professor or I know you're involved in the Department of Family and Social Medicine at Albert Einstein College. Do you want to just give the listeners just a quick background about who you are?
Yeah, sure. So again, I'm Sean Lucan. I'm a family doctor in the Bronx. So I see patients kind of all stages, all ages, and you know, have a general family medicine clinical practice. And then I also do public health research and have an appointment at Albert Einstein College of Medicine in the Bronx.
Brilliant.
So most of my research is about food environments and how where people live affects what they eat and what that means for obesity and chronic disease. But I, you know, I also have an interest in health policy and actually have fellowship training in health policy research. So
wonderful.
So some broad interests.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. And the reason why I wanted to do this podcast with you is you have written a paper, a commentary. I know, in fact, you've got all kinds of publications out there, but specifically what piqued my interest was something that I've covered a number of times in this podcast series on calories. And you wrote a paper that I thought was wonderful, which I'll just let the folks know that this is in Public Health Nutrition. The title of your paper was How Calorie-Focused Thinking About Obesity and Related Diseases May Mislead and Harm Public Health, an Alternative. And I know folks can look that up. Is that open access? I know I got this from your ResearchGate account.
Yeah, so I don't believe the journal site is open access, but interested listeners can access it freely from my ResearchGate account.
Yeah,
which I can provide a web link to.
Yeah,
you know,
great. Yeah. No, well, we'll do. I've been a bit busy with this podcast, so I've been meaning for a while now to create a page per podcast. So on there, I'll start to put links to the various guests. So in your case, we'll put a link to your paper and so on.
I think if you Google my name in ResearchGate,
yeah, it came up. That's how I got it. So, you know, we've talked about energy balance. We've talked about calories in various ways, Sean. And I've had everyone on from, for example, Stephen Guionet, who's a neurobiologist on your side of the pond. And we talked about sort of the neurobiology of this and eating behavior and, you know, why perhaps we shouldn't be focused specifically on calories, but more from a, you know, what drives the calories in type stuff. I've talked with various people about what calories are. I firmly believe something which I think you're going to like, which is basically this idea of, you know, calories do count, but we can't count calories. It's a bit misleading, and that's what I hope to get into with you. It's a big, complex topic, of course, but the reason why I like getting experts like yourself in is because you're not just someone that does research or has done research, has published stuff. You're a practitioner. And I think when we start talking about these things in the context of the real world, in people's homes, in people's lives, it's important, because sometimes the academic or intellectual debate of things like energy balance and the various laws of thermodynamics and so on, or studies that relate to feeding studies of rats in cages in controlled environments and so on, it's all relevant, but not necessarily in the context of the average person, even pretty much everyone listening to this podcast. So I've got lots of things I want to get into, and hopefully I'll extract them out of your brain, Sean. But firstly, what led you to even publish this paper, this commentary?
I think this is a paper that I've been wanting to write for a long time. So I took my first formal course in nutrition in college, you know, sometime as an undergraduate. And, you know, even then, just with kind of the rudiments of learning about nutrition and learning about calories and what they were. And, you know, at that time, you know, over 20 years ago now, you know, there was a lot of focus on counting calories and calorie balance and calories in and calories out. And we actually did this software simulation in class where, you know, we looked at what we ate for, you know, a couple of days and entered into this, you know, food data bank and, you know, came up with various, you know, metrics about the kind of foods we were eating in terms of, you know, macronutrient distribution, vitamins, minerals, but also calories. And what I found was so striking about that exercise was that, you know, the margin for error around those estimates was so far in excess of, you know, anything that might be achieved by conscious control. And so, you know, even from the onset, it didn't make much sense to me, you know, as a consumer to be paying much attention to this notion of calories. It's kind of beyond the consumer's level of understanding or control, and something that wasn't so helpful or, useful to actual eaters. And then, as you know, I went through my public health training and particularly my clinical training and just dealing with patients. I mean, talking to them, you know, most patients have no idea what a calorie is first, let alone how to count them.
Yeah.
And even the most, you know, knowledgeable, you know, motivated, best intended patients who want to, you know, keep track of their calories and count them very accurately and precisely are, you know, challenged by doing so. I mean, there isn't really a good way to, you know, figure out precisely what you're eating or what you're taking in, and moreover, you know, not just ingesting but absorbing. Mm. And so, I find that clinically, it's a phenomenally unhelpful, ineffective, and non-productive exercise.
Absolutely, and I, you know, I sort of alluded to this at the beginning. And we will do get into this in some detail, but we should preface all of this by saying we're not, you know, you're not disputing that energy balance isn't relevant. We're not saying that calories are not relevant to this discussion, but it is this idea that scientists have a better understanding as to what a calorie is as opposed to members of the public, and that's where the disconnect seems to occur, doesn't it? So, I mean, what, you know, in your paper, for example, you've got a number of really interesting points that you make in some sections, but at its most fundamental level, what do you feel is the biggest problem with us being focused on calories specifically?
Well, I think, as you said or alluded to, you know, calories absolutely count, but I think we absolutely should not be counting them. Mm. And so, as I said, clinically, I think it's unproductive. It doesn't lead patients to a place where they have better control over their weight, or more importantly, their health. And, you know, also I think that it takes the focus away from what is more important. So I think more broadly, reductionists, you know, kind of perspective on nutrition can lead us astray. So whether that's looking at calories or whether that's looking at fat or whether that's looking at, you know, any other putatively, you know, beneficial or harmful agent in food, you know, if you're not focusing on whole foods, you're kind of missing the whole point. Mm. And so I think the qualitative distinctions in food are much more important, and getting people to focus on the quality of the foods they're eating matters much more than trying to parse out the quantity of food. And there can be real harms, not only clinically, but also from a broader public health perspective in focusing on calories, because it does take that reductionist view, and it creates incentives, you know, for, well, particularly for the food industry to respond in a way that could lead to worsening of obesity and diet-related disease.
Absolutely. I've gotten, as I said, I've talked to various guests about this stuff, and I know in my own practice, I'm lucky I've got my own lab, and one of the things that we do on our clients is we'll do energy expenditure assessments, like a resting metabolic rate assessment. And one thing that's clear is most of the people that I assess, their actual energy needs are not, you know, they're not that close to what the estimate is that you would tap into your, you know, into your nutrition app on your phone, or you'd look up in your chart. And by that, I mean, you know, it can be a good sort of 2-3 as much as 500 calories off from what the estimate is. And yet, and I mean, obviously, and then you've got the whole business of how do you even account for energy expenditure above that. That's a, we can get into that in a minute. But despite that, I've definitely had clients in my office, literally crying, and I'm not laughing about them crying. I should qualify that. What I'm laughing at is the craziness that, that these people will drive themselves insane counting their calories to within one digit, like one or two calories, if at all possible. And they feel that something's wrong with them because they're not achieving their goals despite the level of effort that they have gone to count their calories and match their calories with their efforts. So you've got that level of precision on the one hand, and yet how accurate, you know, is the calorie estimation on the food that they're eating? You know, the difference between an apple grown in England and an apple grown in Costa Rica, for example. I don't even know if they have apples in Costa Rica, but that was just an idea. You know, there's that sort of that mismatch where we're using sort of a precise number, a precision gauge such as a calorie, and yet in reality, this whole thing is really quite rough, isn't it?
It's incredibly rough, and it's incredibly frustrating, and, you know, and heart-wrenching given, you know, patients or clients like you describe. I mean, I've had, you know, similar patients in the office who are just on the verge of tears and, you know, saying to me that they're just, they're cutting up the calories. They're just not eating. They're really trying to, you know, control their portions and restrict what they're eating, and, you know, they're claiming that they're barely eating at all, and yet, you know, they're having no success. They're starving. They're, you know, fatigued, they've got no energy, and they're, you know, irritable and angry and feel awful. And at the same time, they're not losing weight. And, you know, and then society judges them, you know, for having a you know, corpulent body habitus. Mm. And it's just a disaster. And so I think, you know, it really works to patients' disadvantage to be focusing quantitatively in this regard. It's not a practical thing to do. It's not biologically plausible, it's not helpful.
Well, it's clearly not working. And I'm not going to say, you know, there are people who are experts in helping people determine their caloric needs and helping them assess their food diaries, but even then it's an incredibly difficult thing to do, and for the most part pretty much everyone gets it wrong one way or the other, which is what we see out there. You know, people just can't do this stuff.
I think part of the problem there is the focus on the quantitation. So one of the points that I make in the paper is that if you focus on food quality, if you choose real food, if you avoid, you know, kind of the garbage food that promotes intake and promotes calorie imbalance, then your calories are you achieve better calorie control unconsciously without even thinking about it. Yeah. So just by choosing food that's, you know, more has a higher nutritional quality, you do better overall in terms of energy balance.
And we've definitely got into that, because eating a poor quality food that ultimately makes you feel not so good will then drive certain behaviors that end up making you eat emotionally, or, you know, that there's all kinds of factors that can influence the energy inside of that. And I don't think anyone really can doubt that when they think about it. But you refer to this idea of calorie equivalency, you know, otherwise known as a calorie is a calorie. Could you sort of explore that a bit, please?
Yeah, so I mean, I think a popular expression here is a calorie is a calorie. I don't know, across the pond, maybe you say a joule or a kilojoule. I'm not sure.
No, we're still in the calories. Actually, we're supposed to be joules, as we know. Yeah. In the university, it's all about joules. But even then, we still have to sit there with a calculator. Yeah.
Well, that's good. So then the expression translates. Yeah. So, when people say that, and that was actually one of the inspirations for this piece too. I mean, like I said, it's kind of been smoldering in the subconscious for a while, but really what kind of brought it to a head and made me want to write this was being at two academic sessions, both with, kind of thought leaders in the field or, quote unquote experts. Both of whom, incidentally, don't treat patients at all, so they're kind of experts in their ivory towers. Mm. But, both of them had said in their talks, kind of outright, a calorie is a calorie, let's leave it at that and move on. And I was just so, flabbergasted by that and so worked up by that whole notion that kind of inspired, much of this piece, or at least led to the beginnings. And so the piece starts out, as you said, talking about calorie equivalency, which is that very idea that a calorie is a calorie is a calorie. And so, a calorie is a unit of energy, and, any unit of energy equals any other unit of energy, just as any unit of anything equals any unit of the same anything, right? I mean, that's just mathematical identity. Mm. But when people say a calorie is a calorie, that's not what they're saying generally, or generally not what they're implying. What they're implying is that, any food supplying, one calorie of energy has the same biological effects for, obesity and body weight and energy utilization as any other food providing one calorie. And I think that's demonstrably false, right? So, different foods with different macronutrient distributions have very different implications for body weight and body fat and, metabolic health.
So when people are discussing this stuff, particularly... most commonly it's going to be referred to in the discussion on weight management, weight loss. And, most of the listeners to this podcast, of course, will be very familiar with that term, body composition, and, the need to differentiate weight from fat mass and lean mass and that sort of thing. But since your expertise is very much in the medical field and in the public health, how much of a problem do you feel that is in this kind of research?
How much of a problem is what?
The idea that when you are talking about things like energy deficits and calories and so on, some of that research that helps lead to some of this thinking is very much based on the idea of weight loss, but not specifically fat loss.
Oh, yeah. So I think that's a huge problem. And I think that's a huge way that the conversation is framed in a way that's not very productive. So people are always talking about weight and being overweight and losing weight, when weight is not so much the issue. In fact, you can be, a normal weight, but still be, what people have called metabolically obese. Mm. Or, another term that people use in the lay press is skinny fat. So you can be skinny on the outside, but kind of, fat on the inside, so to speak. So to kind of have the metabolic, profile of someone who's much heavier. And I think, it's a real issue because, obesity in many people's perceptions is just this calorie balance or this calorie imbalance notion, right? So it's almost like units of weight on a scale. You have more in than more out, and so you become heavier, and that's the problem. But if you look at obesity as a problem, as a metabolic problem, as a problem, related to metabolic dysfunction, then the problem occurs before there's any gain in weight. And in fact, people can gain body fat before there's any change in weight at all. And they can even lose weight, but still become fatter and become unhealthier depending on the foods they choose. And that's a real issue.
Yeah. I find fascinating is this idea that the problems that are associated with weight gain or specifically fat gain will start to happen before you even start to gain weight. and that idea of metabolic obesity as opposed to someone who's just gaining weight, and you know, and I guess we see that out there. You look at in certain sporting arenas, like in the marathon, for example. So you see some fairly overweight people who can run 26 miles.
Right.
You see sumo wrestlers who, you look at studies on them, and they've done, you know, DEXA scans, and whilst they're, you know, visually really quite obese, they have fairly low levels of visceral fat. And this idea that being fat does not necessarily make you, you know, super unhealthy. I think obviously there comes a point where obese is not good, however you look at it. However, we need to stop thinking of this as simply energy balance, and therefore weight gain is bad and weight loss is good, because clearly there's far more complexity to this situation.
Agreed.
Yeah. So with the sort of biological side of this, I mean, what do you feel are the most pertinent sort of biological metabolic factors behind obesity then?
Well, you know, I mean, obesity is a complicated issue, and there are probably lots of drivers, and it depends, you know, kind of where in the chain you look at it. So, you know, I come from a public health background and a health policy standpoint. So I look at a lot of, you know, kind of fundamental drivers like, you know, socioeconomics and, you know, social status and you know, people's lived experiences the contexts of where they live and how their environment shapes their behavior. But if you look kind of more downstream towards, you know, more towards the actual effects on the individual, you know, there are certain behaviors, I think, which are detrimental. And what we highlight in the paper is just one example, which is, you know, the differences in food quality. And I think that's kind of the intermediary between, you know, life situation and, you know, individual, you know, the effects on the individual in terms of body weight and obesity and, you know, overall health status. So the example we talk about in the paper is that, you know, a calorie is not a calorie and different macronutrients matter. And specifically, we talk about, you know, the idea that among the calories that may be most detrimental, or among the types of food that may cause the most problem for this, are those that contain, you know, rapidly absorbable carbohydrates. Mm. So, you know, refined, you know, concentrated sugars and sweets, you know, table sugar, high fructose corn syrup, other, you know, manufactured sweeteners, and then refined starches like white rice, white bread, you know, other foods made with white flour, potentially white potatoes, and talk about the different, you know, consequences of eating those types of foods and what that might mean for overall health.
So do you, I mean, what role do you think the environment has? You know, we talk about an obesogenic environment. And obviously that in itself is a podcast, of course. It's more than that, it's a PhD or two or three PhDs. I mean, it's a big subject. I mean, but I guess what we're talking about here is the environment plays a role, and by that I mean, you know, I don't mean just looking outside the window, or, you know, we're talking about factors such as where you live, your financial circumstances, the stresses and strains that we're under, likes, dislikes, religious restrictions on foods, marketing, I think, is a big one. I mean, this is a difficult world we live in.
Sure.
I mean, but, you know, if we're not going to be focusing necessarily specifically on calories in a real world sort of practical point of view, how do you think we should be negotiating our environment?
So, you know, I think environment differs depending on who you are. So, you know, I work in a lower income minority community in the Bronx. So it's one of the poorest communities in the country. And, you know, disproportionately, there is exposure to unhealthy food and unhealthy food marketing. And by unhealthy food, I mean, you know, prepackaged, highly processed, refined products that are loaded with, starches and concentrated sugars. And those are the things that people are, that people have access to, that they're exposed to, that they're, advertisers are marketing to them, and that, you know, become a part of their daily routines and their, the kinds of foods that they're living on, and to the expense of real food, which is either not available in the environment or difficult to access, both physically and in terms of price. And so what winds up happening is you have, you know, generations of people, growing up eating these kind of industry concocted products, which are among the, you know, least healthy of foods and the ones that are most, you know, obesogenic, to use your word, not having access to and not, developing food preferences and food habits and food behaviors around higher quality, real whole food. So I, you know, I often say to my patients, you know, real food, healthy food comes from growing, living, green plants, not industrial processing plants. And healthy food comes from farms, not from factories. And unfortunately, what most of my patients wind up eating is foods from factories and foods from industrial processing plants, foods that industry is making for them. Rather than, you know, fresh whole foods that they make themselves. And those industry-created foods are, you know, injected with, you know, lots of, you know, among other things, starches and sugars, which is what we highlight in the paper as being, you know, particularly problematic from a metabolic standpoint and might be a key driver in the obesity problems that we're having.
Yes, of course. And it gets all a bit gray and shady because, obviously, one of the things that the manufacturer, the business, wants you to do is to keep buying their products. So repeat business is important to them. So there will be all kinds of factors there, the taste of the food, the presentation of the food, and the packaging and the marketing. But at the end of the day, they'll do whatever they can to get you to buy their products again. And obviously, that's going to be highly influenced by the taste. And therein lies some of the issues, because, of course, adding sugar and certain kinds of fats to foods is particularly, you know, particularly pleasurable to our pleasure centers and taste buds and various other things.
There's no question about that. But I do think that a lot of tastes and preferences and habits are driven by what's familiar. So you know, people have a sweet tooth and they can be habituated to eating these highly processed foods and have a preference for them. By the same token, if you start to eat, you know, more whole foods, more real foods, more foods that come more from kitchens as opposed to from laboratories, you develop a taste for those and you start to reject. Your preferences change and your tastes change. And so, you know, if we can change consumer demand, like you said, I mean, industry just wants to profit. And so industry will respond to meet that demand. And so, you know, a good example just recently in the news was Nestle. Nestle, a big food company, has just decided in their candy lines that they're going to be doing away with, I think, artificial colors and flavors, because they recognize that there's a big consumer demand now. People are concerned about where their food comes from, and they want, you know, natural ingredients, and they want ingredients that they can identify and pronounce and know what they are. And so, you know, irrespective of these, you know, products that have been around for a long time and have established very loyal consumer bases, Nestle is going to tinker with those recipes now and remove those things that have sold well in the past, because now there's demand for something healthier, a better alternative. And that's just a small step in the right direction. But I think, you know, if we can move people more towards choosing whole foods, choosing real foods, choosing foods that aren't, prepackaged and processed and refined,
sure,
that overall health will improve.
Yeah, I mean, I know some good points there. I'm certainly interested to see where that will go. And Nestle is huge over here as well. Well, of course, it's a Swiss company, isn't it, I think? Anyway,
I'm not sure where they're based.
I think it's a French-Swiss company originally. Anyway, I work a lot with athletes. That's my main client base. And one group of my athletes are weight restricted or weight focused. By that I mean they can't go above or below a certain weight for their weight category. And I know for them that one reason why they like calories is because all they got to do is pick up that package and it says right on the label how many calories there are. And it's basic mathematics at that point. If I have this sandwich that's packaged, if I have that product that's packaged, it's kind of easy to follow my sort of calorie needs. But of course, we talked about that earlier. You know, firstly, the calorie target is probably not particularly accurate, and the labeling of the amount of calories in that food is also not particularly accurate. But then on the other side of the coin, people that don't look at calories, you know, some people will have concerns that they may over or under consume certain foods, who may have too much fat in there or whatever, because there's nothing there to restrict them. So one argument is, well, at least I know roughly how many calories are in that sandwich or that packet. How do I control my calorie intake where there is a specific goal in mind, which could be obviously weight loss?
Yep.
What do you think about that?
So I think, and that leads to some other pieces that I've written recently around portion size, which is a related issue. Let's just suppose that what's on the label is accurate, that the number of calories contained within that package actually reflects what's in the food, and that's measured with some accuracy and some precision. The problem is that that meal or that food or that item the amount of calories that's delivered in consuming that is not what matters. What matters is the overall calories consumed during the day or over many days and the metabolic effects of those calories. So even if you were to choose something lower in calories, so I just, just this past week put a opinion piece in Forbes, on Forbes Online.
Okay.
And the point I made there was that let's take two different salads. So let's take a salad with, walnuts and avocado and olive oil versus one that's tossed with, croutons and craisins, which are these, sweetened cranberry fruit chews, and then some, fat-free ranch dressing. Well, if you look at the calorie content of those two salads, the salad with the nuts and the avocado and the olive oil is going to be a lot more calories.
Mm.
And the salad with the croutons and the craisins and the fat-free ranch dressing is going to be a lot fewer calories. So someone who is consciously trying to control their calories would consume the latter salad or would choose the latter salad. But the croutons and the craisins and the fat-free dressing, which are full of, sugars and starches, and other rapidly absorbable carbohydrates, are foods that are going to, increase appetite and increase drive to eat and result in greater consumption probably later in the day. So even though the index item has lower calories, the overall consumption of calories throughout the day is probably going to be greater. And it's probably going to be greater consumption of more rapidly absorbed sugars and starches, and those are going to have detrimental metabolic effects. Conversely, the person who chooses the salad with the olive oil and the walnuts and the avocado, so even though that salad has more calories, they're going to feel fuller, and they're probably not going to consume as much later in the day, and so their overall calorie intake might be less, and the metabolic consequences of eating those foods are on the positive side. So, rather than inciting all this dysfunction, you actually, wind up these are foods that are associated with, health benefits, even mortality benefits.
Mm.
So I think, looking at the calories posted on a package is, incredibly misleading and doesn't get at the real issue, which is overall calorie control. So how do people control their calories? They control them by choosing foods that allow them to make calorie control more possible unconsciously.
Yeah.
So they shouldn't. So yes, calories count, as you said before, and yes, we absolutely should not be counting calories, also, as I believe you said before.
Yeah.
That is my contention.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, I'm not trying to be biased about it. It's just like you, I'm a practitioner, and I just know how difficult it is. And as I said before, in my lab, and I'm certainly not the only one that does this, lots of people do this, but once you start assessing people's energy needs in and out and so on, you just start to realize how rough the whole thing is. So, you know, you made a good point just there. And we've talked about the importance on this podcast before about the importance of energy balance from a 24-hour point of view, as opposed to a single section of a day, such as a meal or a snack, you know. And that 24-hour energy balance is influenced by many, many factors. So,
well, I would say, and just interject, I interrupt rather. So I think, you know, it's not just the 24-hour energy balance, but it's the overall energy balance, you know, in perpetuity. So it's not just that day, but extends beyond that day, you know, even into the next day or possibly the next. And the calories we consume today have real implications for what our appetites are, what our cravings are, and what our food choices are in the coming days. And when you say, how can we help people control their calories, you know, I think our bodies are very smart that way. I mean, you know, calorie intake and calorie expenditure are physiologically linked. Mm. So when you look at people's caloric needs, I mean, your body will tell you that. I mean, you will consume the number of calories that you need. And if you choose them, if you choose high quality calories, you will stay in caloric balance. If you choose, you know, calories that tend to uncouple that relationship, that tend to drive hunger and drive consumption of more calories, then you're in trouble.
Yeah. Well, I like the chart or the schematic that you put in your paper, which is this sort of comparison between calorie focused thinking and a more nuanced thinking as an approach to this. So we're sort of getting to the end of this podcast here, so could you just quickly take us through those two processes?
You're talking about the figure in the paper.
Yeah.
So the paper is set up, you know, comparing kind of, you know, calorie focused thinking, which is the paradigm that we've been talking about. A calorie is a calorie. Calories in over calories out leads to obesity. Calories out over calories in leads to weight loss. And so by calorie focused thinking, expending fewer calories and consuming more calories, or eating more and moving less, leads to obesity, drives obesity, right? So it is a cause of obesity. Mm. Whereas by more nuanced thinking, the idea is that, you know, moving less and eating more are not causes, but actually intermediate results or intermediate effects. Mm-hmm. So the contention is that if you eat certain foods that drive metabolic pathways towards eating more and moving less, then the arrows go in the other direction. So what we say is that, you know, if you're consuming rapidly absorbable carbohydrates, so, you know, sugars and starches, there is an initial kind of short-term reinforcing loop, which is driven by the fact that when you eat those foods, you get rapid rise in blood sugar, insulin rises accordingly. Once that fuel is stored away and stocked up, there's still this insulin around and cravings result. So you get hungry and the body is saying, you know, bring more fuel in. Oh. And so that results in a desire to eat not only more food, but generally also more rapidly absorbable carbohydrates, right? Or something sweet. People get a desire to eat something sweet. Oh. And so in the short term, there's this feedback loop of eating you know, sweet and starchy things leads to increased hunger for more sweet and starchy things leads to more increased hunger, and it just loops around. Over the long term, you know, possibly through those, you know, possibly through those elevations in insulin that are driven by the carbohydrate intake, possibly also through inflammation related to the gut microbiome or other factors, you get hormonal dysfunction. You get leptin resistance. And leptin is kind of that hormone that tells us to stop to stop storing and start spending. Right, to stop eating and start moving. And so when leptin is working properly, it's kind of the anti-hunger hormone. Mm. When leptin gets disrupted, or when the signal gets blocked, or when the signal gets antagonized, then it has the opposite effect. And there are actual physiologic signals to eat more and move less. And so we don't quite understand why that happens. Some people think insulin is the key there to why, you know, the leptin signal gets antagonized. But, you know, leptin is a signal from fat cells to the brain, which, you know, results in other signals to, you know, your heart and your skeletal muscles and your intestines and, you know, other fat cells telling you to eat less and move more. But when that signal gets antagonized, the opposite happens. You wind up eating more and moving less. And so eating more and moving less become the result of fattening as opposed to the cause of fattening, right?
Absolutely.
And so that's the key point of the, you know, it's just kind of the reverse causation, or kind of an opposite thinking of most people's conceptualization. And the implication of that is that, you know, people who choose the wrong kinds of foods, so choose these foods that are, you know, dense and rapidly absorbable carbohydrates, you know, even if they're trying to control their calories, they're still going to have internal signals to eat more and move less. And so they're not going to be losing weight. They're going to remain, you know, obese. And they're going to be, you know, potentially criticized or stigmatized for their prodigious appetites and their, you know, fatigue or their inactivity or their sloth, right? So people are going to be, you know, called gluttons and sloths, you know, for doing the kind of thing that we're trying to, you know, for following the advice that's trying to, you know, help them be slimmer and be healthier. Hmm. And so it winds up being a very destructive message, and one that, you know, creates and blames victims.
Yeah, I had Dr. Lane Norton on the previous podcast to this, and he came up with a comment which I really liked. Was, you know, you can't have the sort of biology without the psychology, and they interact. You know, the psychology influences biology, and the biology influences psychology, and there's a lot to that with this. Listen, we could go on for ages here. I'm afraid that is going to bring us to the end of this in this podcast. I really appreciate your time. It's been great to talk to you about this. I do recommend everyone checks out this paper by Sean Lucan, and you're going to have to pronounce your co-author's name.
So it's James D. Nicolantonio.
Perfect. Okay, you said it, not me. But this paper is available on the internet, How Calorie-Focused Thinking About Obesity and Related Disease May Mislead and Harm Public Health. I will get some links to this on the website very soon. So thank you, Sean, and thank you, all of you, for listening to this podcast. I, of course, am Laurent Bannock, and I will bring another podcast back to you soon. But, of course, you can check out information about the podcast, other podcasts, and all the other things we do at Guru Performance at guruperformance.com.